The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization that more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Bonnie, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our first 10-minute speaker is Jackie T.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jackie, and I'm an alcoholic calling in from New York City, Manhattan, and before you all ask, Upper West Side. And my home group is the Atlantic Group. My sponsor is a member of this meeting. Her name is Sharon C. And I definitely want to give out a shout out to all my sober sisters that are here, the celebrants tonight. My friend Penny is celebrating. And to all the newcomers that are raising the hands. And that's pretty cool. And I am so grateful to be here tonight. And Marty, thank you. Well, more about Marty in the call later on. But I just want to get into this that I'm in a good place today. I am really grateful. And I'm sober. And my sobriety date is June 21st, 2002. So that's 18 and a half years. And I got sober when I was 42. And I started drinking when I was 13 and 14. And since I don't want you guys doing math, I'm 62 and a half years old. So let's talk. So I did about 26, 28 years of drinking. And I don't know if anybody else in this room had fun. I mean, I love to drink. Anybody else? Hands? I mean, I loved drinking. And like I said, I'm from New York and I'm third generation and I lived down in Chelsea back in the 80s. And that's when I did a lot of clubbing. There was Kamikaze, there was Limelight, there was Bond Street, Studio 54, Heartbreak, wherever it was, I wanted to party. And the job that I had at the time was at a television studio it was a 24/7. So I wanted to work weekends because I didn't want to hang out with the bridge and tunnel crowd. I wanted to drink with the solid people during the week. And my first drink, I'll just tell you how the disease started in with me. I was 15, 16 years old. I always wanted the next thing. I always wanted to hang out with people because inside I was filled with this fear, self-hatred. And I went into a bar with my cousins and we were doing shots of Southern Comfort and chasing it with the beer. And that's when you could still smoke in bars. And so you know my age. So here we are. It was 8-track tapes, shag carpeting, arriving at the bar in the van with all the boys and doing the shots. And I didn't really like the taste of the Southern Comfort, but I did it anyway. Felt kind of cool. Loved it. And then the next thing I remember is my head hanging out the van window and throwing up. But I did it again and again. So I was having my first blackout, the phenomenon of craving. So for you newcomers, I have an allergy to alcohol. I have an abnormal reaction. When the alcohol comes into my body, it's going to continue. And that's what we learned about from Dr. Silkworth. And throughout my life, I was a liar. I was a cheat. I woke up in many places that I shouldn't have been in. My mom wanted me to be a nurse. I went to nursing school and I picked up with some patient, some guy that was in the army and took me to Europe back in the late 70s. He was my patient. He goes, oh, I need a nurse. I get to London. There's no room for me. Where am I sleeping? He goes, with me. So I was just pushing, as Sharon says, just pushing my dignity across and hurting my family. And then one day I woke up in a hotel room and I had signed a piece of paper and I don't even remember, I came up out of a blackout that I was married to him. And I moved out of my parents' house and I know now today how much I hurt my family, but I was so selfish and self-centered that it didn't matter because it was about how much I wanted to drink. And if a guy or anybody says, I like you, I want to be with you, I followed them because I had no self-esteem. And when I talk about it, I talk about like this iceberg theory, that the top third is the excessive sex, the excessive drinking, the drugs, whatever, bulimia, anorexia. But that bottom two thirds is how I'm going to be filled with the fear, the self-hatred. But then I told you I'm from New York, so I have this grandiosity. I have this, and I also have this negative thinking. And how are we going to melt those, that two thirds is going to be the steps and working with a sponsor and sponsoring others. So I was off to the races at a long time. I kept drinking and partying and not showing up for my family. And like I said, it was fun for a very long time. And then by 30, the hangover started. I started getting the consequences of the drinking. The job started to change. The relationship with the man, when his sister came, oh, 5 minutes, cool. When his sister came to see me and says, when are you and my brother getting married? I said, we're already married. She goes, no, you're not. But it still took me 2 more years before I would leave him. And then I wound up in hospital, in doctor's hospital in traction. And then finally, I did get away from him. I did keep drinking because, like I said, I had a disease. I didn't know I had a disease. So there were many failed relationships. I thought my parents were the enemy. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in through the back door and through Al-Anon. By then, I had done a geographic. I moved to Los Angeles. I picked up with one of my friends and we were living together. But any of the relationships I had, none of the guys would tell me to stop drinking. Because if they did, I would just cancel a checking account and I'd be out the door. Because I wanted to drink and party. And then in 97, when the alcohol stopped working, I went and got elective bunion surgery just so I could mix it. And now here we go into my recovery. And like I said, I came in through Al-Anon. And the girls there told me to go to an open AA meeting. So Pacific Group, you had me first in October of 99. And like I said, I didn't get sober till 02. Well, the alcohol was 01, but I wound up changing my sobriety date. Because like we said, it's a program of rigorous honesty. And as Clancy talks about too, anything above the neck. So here I am at my first meeting, lining up on Sunset. I mean, I came drunk to every meeting I came to before I moved back to New York and came to the Atlantic Group. And my first sponsor didn't want to sponsor me, but her sponsor made her because I was out of my mind. So now today, I mean, so much for 10 minutes that, you know, I hope that the newcomers can see that there is hope because I did a lot of damage to my mom. And as Sandy Beach would talk about, I've been rewriting my childhood because my mom tells me stories and I'm like, oh. So resentments that I might have held on to for 50 years are gone today. I have a God in my life. And okay, so we've been involved in this pandemic for over a year. I've been living in survival mode and stress mode, and I've been working at ABC Television, and I have had a job for 28 years. And the guys there at my job, when I started in 93, when I was still drinking and they knew it, and they would tell me, oh, Jackie, you used to take off your top. And I would go, I did not. And they said, yes, you did. And then now these coworkers and colleagues, they see me as being a sober woman. And I've broken my anonymity. I mean, not at the level above, you know, on the air, but my colleagues know that if somebody needs help, that they could come to me. And last year we got news that the New York offices, LA offices were closing and moving to Texas. So a job that I've had for 28 years was going away. So I got into some fear. I did some prayers. I kept trusting. Well, we closed the doors on Sunday at 2 a.m. Now I was so full. I had been crying. And I don't know about you guys with drinking. It's like I drank when I was happy. I drank when I was sad. I drank when I was pissed off at something. Well, what happened is I've been doing a lot of crying. And I can have this hard tomboy, you know, figure, you know. But now as I've been working with Sharon and the girls, I've softened up. I want to be with you guys. I want to be real today. I want to see these emotions. And here I am today. I made a little video. And I put it out on YouTube and Mr. Marty happened to see it. So I think that might be the secret to come to speak at PG. make a really sad video that people are going to cry about and like it a lot. And then maybe you too can be asked to speak at PG. So that's what Marty did. He called me. And what that said to me immediately, what I knew, I joke a little bit, but I hit me that God has already taken care of me, because I work a hard program to lead an easy life. And if I keep putting God and sobriety first, AA first, I'm going to be okay. And in the past couple of days, I've started to get emails to come to work. And I know that's an outside issue, but tomorrow I'm going to be working up at the stadium for opening day. So I know I'm taken care of. I have a prudent reserve. And when this is over, I can't wait to come back and see all you guys and give you guys hugs. And I've been vaccinated and my time is about up. And shout out to Clancy too. Okay. Bye, everybody.
Thank you. Our second 10-minute speaker is Drew F.
Drew Friedman, alcoholic. Marty, thank you for asking me to speak. And I am very glad this is on Zoom, so I can tell you all how profoundly nervous I am and not hear everyone's reaction. A couple formalities. I have a sobriety date. It's September 2nd, 2018. My sponsor is Robert K, and this is my home group. Before I start, I want to sincerely welcome anyone who's newly sober or new to AA or returning to AA. I mean, it's 2.5 years ago for me, but I just know all too well how difficult it is to be in early sobriety. And I can tell you, for me, you know, when I first decided to come to AA, I thought it was the beginning of the end of my life. I thought I was officially sentenced to a life of boring, glum, fragile, blah. And it's been anything but that. Coming to AA has been the single greatest decision in my life, and I can confidently say it will be throughout it. My job is to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So we can start with what it was like. Obviously not great. Here I am. I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I have no alcoholism in the family tree. I really grew up in a fairy tale. I was raised in Montecito by two incredible parents who gave me all of the love, care, resources, and guidance that any young man would need to be a good little successful citizen in life. I had wonderful teachers, wonderful friends. Their parents were amazing. Like, I was dealt the best hand you can be dealt. But why I'm an alcoholic doesn't really matter. There's one thing or a few things that are they're for damn sure. And that's when I drink, I can't stop drinking. And when I stop drinking, I can't stay stopped. And I also have a handful of characteristics that I think are quite similar to other folks here in Alcoholics Anonymous, which we'll get into. My story isn't particularly exciting. Netflix hasn't called to develop my story yet. And I don't expect them to. But my disease was very slow and progressive. I like to say that I was like a 777 with one engine missing. I was flying, kind of getting by, but losing altitude until the plane ran out of gas and started to crash. It started with some casual high school drinking, going out on the weekends, having some fun. And from there, it turned into, you know, having a beer or two every night, to a six pack every night, to a 12 pack every night, to a couple bottles of wine, to a fifth of vodka. And I don't know exactly when, but at some point I crossed the line and I lost all control over my relationship and consumption of alcohol. And it got pretty bad and it was getting worse. You know, when it was tough for me to come to AA, I always justified the fact that I never had a DUI and I didn't wake up in strange places and I wasn't the crazy guy in the bar and didn't get in fights, that that I wasn't an alcoholic, but here's the fact of the matter. I couldn't make it through 5 minutes of the day for a couple of years without obsessing about alcohol or usually drinking it. I was literally a prisoner. I hardly left my apartment. I was calling in all the time to figure out ways to work from home so I could drink, or I'd go to work drunk. I stopped doing things with my wife. I stopped seeing my friends. The world was big and scary, and I didn't know how to manage it, and I hid and drank and drank and drank. I remember having a place out in Santa Monica right out of by the bluffs, and during the summer it would be gorgeous out, and I'd watch all of the people parking their cars and getting out with their friends and family, getting ready to go enjoy a nice day at the beach, and I'd just look out and just wonder, what the hell is wrong with me? Why can't I just be like them and enjoy life and not be stuck inside drinking alcohol? And the funny thing is, I always thought that when I decided, I could stop. I just needed the right reason. And I always had an excuse why it wasn't going to be today. It's Thursday night, Thursday night football, have to drink tonight. Friday, new shows on Netflix, gotta drink tonight. And the most convenient one, it's been a really stressful day or week. I deserve a drink. And that cycle went on for years. It was always going to be tomorrow, always the next day, always Monday. I always picked Monday. And then I drink on Monday and have to push it to next Monday. Until that moment of reckoning came. My wife one evening came into the room with a big grin on her face, and she handed me a card, and I opened it. And it was a surprise. We're expecting a baby. And I did some quick math, some calculations, and I deduced that my drinking and a baby probably couldn't coexist. The moment had come. I'd need to stop drinking. And that's what I did. I pulled out all the tricks. I went to the gym. I went on a diet, read a lot of Tony Robbins, you name it. And I strung together 16 weeks of sobriety. It was by far the most time I'd put together in a long, long time. And 16 weeks in, we went to the doctor, and the doctor gave us some bad news. And the baby had Turner syndrome, and essentially we had to terminate the pregnancy. And for my wife, that was probably the worst news she ever got. But for me, it was a sigh of relief. I had dodged the bullet of responsibility, and I could go on drinking. And we got in the car and had a quiet drive home. And on the way, I stopped at the liquor store, picked up a bottle, and I was off again for one last time. Fast forward to September 2nd. I don't know what was special about that day. There really wasn't anything special. I woke up at 7 in the morning, which is, I like to wake up early so I could drink the entire day. And I went to the fridge and put a bottle of wine up to my lip, and I stopped. And I'm traveled into the future, into my older self, and I felt this profound sense of remorse and regret of lost time. And I put that bottle down, and I went and lied on the couch, and I prayed to a God that I didn't believe in. And I asked for help, and I closed my eyes, an intuitive thought came, and that was that I should go to AA. Unfortunately, that intuitive thought said I should go to AA in a couple days. But I, God willing, managed to not drink throughout that time, and I went to a meeting. And I wish I could tell you that it was a eureka moment for me. It wasn't. That first meeting was a lot of what I had imagined AA to be in my head. It was depressing, sad. I sat there alone. I felt like a stranger in a room full of people who knew each other their entire lives. And I didn't hear the message at all. And I went home really discouraged, and I decided I'd go to one more meeting. I'd try one more time. And I went to that same room a night later, and it was really depressing, and that was going to be my last meeting ever. And a man came up to me. He was wearing a suit and a tie, and he sat next to me, and he asked me my name. And he asked me how I was doing. And he asked me to go to dinner with him. He gave me a meeting book. He circled meetings that he goes to. He asked me to join him to meetings. he asked me to, or recommended that I call him every day to check in. He introduced me to AA. He made me feel welcome here. And that man completely changed the trajectory of my life. And I love that man very, very much. I'm running out of time. All I can tell you is I am so grossly overpaid. I know we hear that a lot here, but for me, it's really true. I thank God that I'm not paid in the currency of my choosing. If it were up to me, I'd be drowning in money and Lamborghinis and cars and all the things that I think will make me happy but never do. I've been paid with so much more. The obsession to drink is gone. I have a peace that is really, I think, what I've been searching for my entire life. And I have a beautiful 19-month-old girl who is the joy of my life. And if left to my own devices, she wouldn't be in it. So thank you, AA. Thank you, Pacific Group. And I love you all.
Hi, my name is Cliff Roach, and I'm an alcoholic. I just like my entrance. I got sober in 1970. In 1971, I thought of this coming up here because I was watching me. In 1971, our founder, Bill Wilson, died. And they had a big meeting for him down in San Diego, a memorial meeting for Bill Wilson. And all the speakers were people that knew him personally from the old days when in New York. And one of the speakers was Jimmy Burwell. He was the guy in the early days who fought and scraped and argued and infuriated everybody, but he got it in the book, God As You Understand Him, so guys like me could stay here. Anyway, Jimmy Burwell is about the age I am now, old. And I was working backstage helping, and Burwell had emphysema. He was in the terminal stages. And there were about three little steps to get him up on the stage so he could come out here, you know. And I had to almost lift him. And he tottered across the stage, you know. Hi, I'm Jim Burwell, and I'm an alcoholic. You know. What is it with microphones and alcoholics? You know, you get well immediately. I'm delighted to be here. I'm absolutely delighted to be part of this meeting. A lot of good old friends in this room. Lots of real friends, old-time friends, and a lot of spirits in this room. It's a spiritual program. A lot of spirits in this room. I'm happy as hell. My beloved Al-Anon is with me tonight. Pat. She rarely comes and usually dozes off immediately. But I love her dearly. We've been married 61 years. I'm 20 years drunk and 41 years sober. The other day she said, I can't tell the difference. She drove me up here tonight, God bless her. She was a terrible pre-Al-Anon, remember them? You married guys, you remember that, don't you?
Don't you think you had a few too many?
Nah, you had a few too few, that's your problem, lady. And she was a counter, that's all the counters, they're...
That's your fifth one today.
Shut up and eat your breakfast. Leave me the hell alone. I came to this group when I was 3 days sober. This little sponsor I had, Bill Blake, he lived in Oceanside also. And I was 3 days sober and... I'd come to meetings in and out for 5 years in Oceanside, and there was some good AA in Oceanside, but rather subdued, you know. And so we came up here, it was down on Ohio Street, the first meeting I came to, and it just blew me away, the energy and the zinging each other. And You know, everybody was having such a good time. I hadn't laughed in 2 years. Well, the only way I could laugh was like, you know, as you fell down and got hurt. Some goof was up there talking, and I went, ha ha! It's like stitches tearing in my stomach. And I've been laughing ever since. I was a very unsuccessful drinker, although I've never met anybody in my life who had more good times drinking than I did. Oh, God, I had a lot of good times drinking. But I would have that, I'd take that drink I shouldn't. Remember that one? I always wondered which one it was, 5, 7, 9, whatever. But I always knew when I got to it, didn't you? I always knew. My brain would say, this is it. You drink this one, you're going to do tricks. And you know what I said? Well. You know. And then I would have a few drinks after that. And I was a kamikaze drinker. You know, about 3 drinks after that, it was bonsai! And I would run amok. And I took thousands of beatings, terrible beatings, because I was a tough guy, you know. I had to get enough booze to be brave. Unfortunately, then I would lose my muscle coordination. Yeah. You can get hurt doing that. You really can get hurt. And I wrecked cars, and I lost friends, and it was just I never had a good blackout, did you? I looked for years for somebody who had, I had delightful blackouts. Yes, thank you. No, not moi. It was always trouble. It was always horrible. I always hated him. Pat and I met right after I'd won World War II, and we got married. He entered this suicide pact together, and we had a dual disease. We had alcoholism and Catholicism, and we had a kid every 9 months and 20 minutes. Seemed that way to me, I'll guarantee you. You know, I'd come out of a blackout. What the hell is that? And they're all right when they're little, you know, like kittens. But we had 5 of them, and when they grow up, they get weird. Not as weird as her, or not as weird as me, but they were all weird. I had become a school teacher. I commits felonies and blackouts, becomes a school teacher. All right. I was a good one. I'll brag. That's all I'm bragging you'll get out of me tonight. I was a high school teacher, and I was a very good high school teacher. You know, I love the kids. Kid loves me, et cetera, et cetera. Somebody asked Pat one time why I was such a good high school teacher. She said, he's a very well-educated adolescent. Don't you hate it when they're accurate and cruel? You know. But anyway, I was a successful high school teacher, and when we moved to Oceanside, California, being a macho guy, I became a surfer dude, and I loved surfing. Oh, God, I loved surfing. I surfed till I was 74 years old. You should have seen me out there. Oh, the kids loved me. They helped Mr. Roach back on his board. There you go. But I went down to the surfboard shop one Sunday morning to repair a board. It was 1965. A lot of you weren't born yet, I know. But I went down, and I had a terrible hangover on Sunday morning. And I wanted to get something out of the refrigerator, a Coke or something. And my buddy, who had the shop, had been there the night before, and he left about this much vodka in a half-pint bottle. And there was some orange juice in the refrigerator, and I thought, that'll put the fire out. And I drank that little drink, and if you're new tonight, I went on, I was sanding the board, about 20 minutes went by, and my mind talked to me. My mind said, shame on you, Cliff. That's Woody's booze you drank. Why don't you go up to the liquor store and get Woody a pint? It's the kind of guy I am. You know? That afternoon I got Woody a fifth. And I just ended, my dad used to call it Bory I'd drunk, you know. Crawled home on my hands and knees, and the next morning I got up, and Pat suggested I call AA, and I called AA. And for the next 5 years, I was an AA loser. I'm a real loser. I had that loser smirk. I'm highly educated, and you people seemed rather dull to me. Had the collective IQ of an orange. And so I would be sober for 40 days, and I'd be drunk for 2 years. And that's a slip. And then I'd come for 30 days, and then I'd be drunk for a year and a half, and on and on and on and on. Terrible loser. But every time, the last couple of times I came, this little guy, Bill Blake, he would pounce on me. You know, when you're a loser, you hate guys like that. You know, old teeth. Hi there. Yeah. And he used to say things to me like, you want to go to Los Angeles with us tomorrow night? No. What I wanted to say was, I can't stand you jerks here. Why would I drive 100 miles to meet some more of you, for God's sake? But I would just say, no, thank you. And that's the way it went. And the last 5-6 years of my drinking, I got drunk at home every day. And I'm a violent drunk and a mean, sarcastic, cruel drunk. And I got drunk at home every night. And we had these 5 kids, and everybody in that house was crazy. The experts on alcoholism say that most people that die of alcoholism are like me. You know, functioning alcoholics. People go to work every day and do the job and do it better than you, do it better than anybody, and come home and get drunk and abuse their family and get up the next day and do it over. A functioning alcoholic. My buddy at home says a functioning alcoholic is one whose wife works. Don't tell that in an Al-Anon meeting. No, they don't think that's funny. Makes them go. But everybody in the house was a lunatic. My oldest son is working his way through high school as a hashish salesman. Never had to give him any spending money, I'll guarantee you. I used to hit him up for a fifth once a week. Yeah, Dad, what do you need? You know. He had hair down to his butt, you know, and his head went like this all the time. Called his mother man. Hey, man, what's for dinner? Oh, you should have seen him. He was a winner, boy. He loved LSD. One of you LSD people here? They see things. Yeah, that's it. Shut up, you're in an AA meeting. But he used to see things. You know, I'd be right in the middle of a sentence, he'd say, what was that? And of course, the shape I'm in, I'd say, I don't know, what was that? Wait, what? And my mother-in-law, my drunken mother-in-law, lived with us, and she would say, I'll explain it. We used to listen to the explanation. I don't know about that. And my eldest daughter was in this sick relationship with this crazy guy. And our middle daughter was 14 and was well into her story. And the two little kids just wet the bed and walked in the walls. They didn't know what the hell was going on. Everybody in that house was insane. No human power could have relieved my family. No human power could have relieved my family. And all that in and out of AA, the week that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous this time, weighed 163 pounds, had 4% body fat. I would surf for like 3 hours, then get out and run 5 miles. Could bench press 280. Took me 20 minutes to pass a mirror. Don't ask me for directions, I'd said right over. There. What do you mean an alcoholic? I'm an Adonis, for God's sakes. I was one of the top 3 debate coaches in the United States. That's like being one of the top 3 prostitutes in Elko, Nevada, you know. I became a top speech coach by mistake. The principal had called me in, and a few years before I got here, and he'd gotten an invitation to a debate and speech tournament 30 miles down the road at San Diego State. And he said, I was teaching a speech class, so he said, why don't you take your kids down there? I'll bet they'll get a lot out of that. And I was in big trouble, so I said, oh, what a good idea, you know. And I found like five or six yo-yos, wanted to give it a try. And we went down to San Diego State. There were like 50 schools participating in this, and like 500 contestants. All the boys were in three-piece suits with vests and ties. The girls, these lovely business clothes. We're in Levi's and sweatshirts. What do we know? And he killed us. We did not win a round. I mean, they ground us in the third team. I don't know what kind of drunk you are, but I'm a poor loser. It ticks me off to lose. And I went in the coach's room. There's about 25, 30 of them in there. And they're all buddies. They've been doing this for years. They're pals. And they snubbed me. So I stay there all day. You know how we are? They snub you more that way. And one guy there really ticked me off. He had a lot of hair. That got me right away. Not just hair. I mean, it's that beautiful silver gray. It took 9 barbers to get it right. He had about $1,000 suit on. The other coaches did this when they went in front of him. And about 2 in the afternoon, this gray-haired Cretan turns to me and says, "Where are you from?" God, I was grateful to be spoken to. I said, "Oceanside." He said, "Oh, where's that?" 30 miles up. I don't know what kind of drunk you are, but he gave me a resentment. And I went back to Oceanside High, and I built me a speech team. Took me 4 or 5 years, but I built me a juggernaut speech team is what I did. I built this powerhouse speech team, and I did it with sheer hatred. Huh? You know how hard that is? Make 150 people do what they don't want to do? I mean, that'll wind you up, baby, from 7 in the morning till 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. I'm in their faces screaming and yelling. Coaching! This reporter asked my captain one time, "What's the key secret to your coach's success?" The kid said, "Terror." She wasn't lying. Oh, that's hard. Especially, don't eat all day, right? Drink like 300 cups of coffee. And stay pissed off. By the end of the day, I'm just wound into a knot. My brain's too big for my head. Every muscle in my body's in a knot. Alaska says, "Good night, Mr. Roach." "Yeah, get the hell out of here." All day in the glove compartment of my 58 Chevy, my surfing car. One time I painted it with house paint. And, you know, everything. It should be in the archives. Alcoholic's car, you know. But in the glove compartment waiting for me, because I'm a functioning alcoholic, there's a half a pint of hot vodka in the seal unbroken. And we'll lie there all day getting hot. And we'll call to me, "Go get him, Cliff, baby. I'm waiting, darling." And I'd finish with that last kidney, and I'd lurch out to the car, light one of those cheap stogies I smoked in those days, and open up that hot vodka. Whatever thrifty had in the basket that week. And I drank half the half pint, always. Just is there anything like hot vodka, huh? I love to talk about hot vodka and Al-Anon meetings. They go, But you and I know, huh? Into the bloodstream. All the muscles relax. Take a deep hit on the stogie. Say, "Damn, you're a good coach." And then I would finish that half a pint and sit there in the darkness of that car. Only car left in the parking lot, all by itself, 10 o'clock at night. And I would have my 8 minutes. Now, I don't know what your story is. If you come down to Carlsbad on a Thursday night, I'm in the front row on your left, and I'll listen to every word you say. But my story is this. After I drink about a half an hour, everything in my life is all right. And I have about 8 minutes where I am enough. I almost died for that 8 minutes. I came that close to dying. See, because that's the only peace of mind I had ever known. I was crazy when I was 4 years old. Lived on the speedway in Venice when I was 4 years old. I'd wait there for cars. When a car would come, I'd go. That's how I felt when I was 4 years old. Didn't know how to do this yet, you know. So spent the day. That's how I lived my whole life. But when I drank for a half an hour, if you'd have stopped me on the street and said, "What's serenity?" I would have said it's about 8 minutes, a half an hour into my drink. Because that's the only peace of mind I thought I would ever know. And I would have my 8 minutes and drive home and destroy my family. And I told you what happened there. We were all crazy. But I built that speech team. And after a couple of years, my team won one of those speech tournaments. But I didn't say anything to the gray-haired guy. It wasn't time yet. We know when it's time, don't we? I think revenge is better than Christmas. The next year, there were like 13, 14 tournaments. My team took first place in every tournament. But I can wait. The next year, there was a tournament. There were 25 schools competing in the tournament. And my team scored more sweepstakes points than the other 24 schools combined. Then I went up to the gray-haired guy. Remember him? I put my nose right against his and I said, "Do you know where Oceanside is now?" And he just looked blank. He said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Don't you remember 4 or 5 years ago?" "You said to me, Oceanside, where's that?" And he said, "We just moved here from Nebraska. I didn't know where it was." The story of my life right there. This guy's in his bed every night. I'm up in Oceanside. I'll get you. And not long after that, we had one of our main events, and I had moved out of the house, and I was drinking, was getting worse. I was drunk every day. I went by the house one afternoon. It was Harang and Pat. And the hashish salesman was kind of standing there in the background. And I turned to my son. I said, "Dave, what's it like not to have your old man around the house?" And my 16-year-old son looked me right in the eye, and he said, "It's beautiful." And I didn't know it for a couple hours. But that's my bottom. That's as far as I'm going. After a couple of hours, I realized that I'd given up my own self-respect a long time before that. And I went in the bedroom and dug out the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had read it in my travels through the program, and I thought it was very poorly written. And it read a lot better this time. And if you're new, I read the big book for 3 days and three nights. I called in sick. I didn't go to work. I slept a little bit, ate even less. For 3 days and three nights, I read the big book of alcoholism. I read it cover to cover. I read every story. I read the appendix in the back. And in the second edition, there was a story called The Professor and the Paradox. And he rang my chime. He was another egotistical school teacher. And he saved me. On the third day at 3 o'clock in the morning, on the January 13th, 1970, I knelt down on that filthy linoleum floor on that dump on the beach. And on page 63, I read that third step aloud to myself. I read, "God, offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self." And I've heard a couple of hundred fifth steps in my years in the program. And the number one defect of character of every man I've ever worked with is self-obsession. Before I was 4 years old, I built a wall here, I guess, to keep you out. I don't know. All I did was build a prison to keep me in. And when I was pretty new, I heard Peggy talk, and she said, "Alcoholism is the only prison where the locks are on the inside." And my little sponsor says, "There's 12 keys to let you out, Cliff. Because you're a brilliant intellectual, we numbered them for you. 1, 2. I'm banging on his door that night. Bill Blake, the guy I told you about, a regular member of this group, an enthusiastic, crazy, loving member of this group. Clancy was his sponsor, and he adored his sponsor. you know, so I didn't like him, but I knocked on the door. Margie, Bill's wife, opened the door. I'm a five-year loser. I'm an overeducated, smirking, pompous-ass loser. And if you're new tonight, if you don't hear me say anything else, hear this. I have never seen anyone so glad to see me in my life. This loser, she just lit up. Oh, Cliff. In the house I go. Pours me a cup of coffee. Oh, this is great. This is wonderful. Bill's been crazy lately. He's had nobody to work with. Oh, this is so good. Then Bill comes in. Ah! Cliff! About a half an hour, I'm thinking, anything else I can do to help you folks out? Anyway, I can help. 3 weeks later, I was at a newcomer meeting, and one of the other newcomers said, what do you mean this is a selfish program? And I knew the answer. I got the answer the night I got here. They were tickled to death for me. They've been praying for me for 5 years. But they were more glad for Bill and Margie, because they knew the great secret better than anyone I've ever known. You can't have it unless you give it away. You can't stay here unless you're willing to give it away. And so that was the last nice thing the man ever said to me, as long as he lived. The nicest thing he said the next 5 years was, shut up. Shut up. I told him, I have degrees, you know. He says, so does the thermometer. You know where they stick that sometimes. I thought the first step was, shut up and get in the car. Now, in the back seat on the hump. You know, there's a method to that, too. You know, if you're the guy in the back seat on the hump, you become a 12-stepper. You find a new guy. Hey, come with us. I'm on the window now, baby. Well, there's a method to that, too. Shut up and get in a car. And all these years later, I've come to the conclusion that is the first step, isn't it? For both halves of the first step, shut up and get in the car. And he took me everywhere in Southern California. The first year was just me. Then Al got sober, Skip got sober, the other gals went by. We had like two carloads of guys. We went everywhere in Southern California every night. He took me to meetings like this one. He took me to this meeting every week. But he took me to meetings where people were laughing. See, I couldn't stay here. You know, if there were only great tunnels left, I couldn't stay here. I got to hear the laughter. I believe laughter is the spiritual part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Especially when you learn to laugh at yourself, huh? Oh, what a turnaround that is, yeah. So if you're new tonight and you can't laugh at yourself, see me after the meeting. I'll be glad to help out any way I can. Oh, I love the laughter. I'll have to get me some new scuzzbag guy, you know, and take him to a meeting and take him to another meeting and take him maybe to 12th or 13th or 14th meeting. He's sitting there beside me and he goes, gotcha! We gotcha. We like to get brand new little Alan on, Pat and I. She's worse than I am. And we take her out, they take this new little Alan on to AA speaker meetings like this, you know. They get her in between us where she cannot escape. And then some guy like me is up here saying, ha, 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 I fell in the Christmas tree and smashed all the presents. Ha, 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 ha. You know, and we're all going, yeah. Ha, ha. And this new little Alan on sitting there. Not funny to her. Till we take her to another meeting tomorrow night. One night she throws her head back and laughs. And I don't care, A or Al-Anon or what have you. You're not here till you start laughing. And you know you belong. And whatever was wrong in my life, and I had lots wrong in my life, and I had all these dope fiend children, you know, and I owed $1 billion and didn't have a brass razoo, and I would have nervous breakdowns. I don't know what you were like when you were new, but I'd go to my sponsor's house and pound on the door, and he'd come to the door, and I'd say, you know what they're doing over there now? Come on in, Cliff. Tell me all about it. I'd go on for 20 minutes sobbing, and you know how they always listen. I found it's good to make a little noise once in a while, like, then they think you're paying attention, you know. But I would finally run down. I'd just run out. You know, I'd just say, and Bill would say, go get Al and take him to the meeting. What has that got to do with the nervous breakdown? I hated Al. He was a bigger loser than I was, you know. But I was afraid of the old fool, so I'd go get Al. He had no driver's license, of course. Big blowhard, drive Al to the meeting. Blah, 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 blah. And we'd get the meeting. We'd set the meeting up, make the coffee, and everybody come. Everybody go home. We'd set the meeting down, you know, wash the coffee pots. He had to do the cups, put his hands in the water. He was so shaky, you know, he'd wash the cups. But I could drive. You know. So I'd load the blowhard in the car, drive him home, blah, 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 blah. And I'd let Al off, and I'd start driving home. And something would happen to me. This feeling, it would start like right here, and then would just spread out through my body. It felt so good, it terrified me. I didn't know what it was. It only lasted maybe 40 seconds. You know, I thought it's because I got rid of Al. But I stood at the door and greeted you, and I mopped up your coffee, and, you know, I set up the chairs, and I set down the chairs, and I listened to your whining, and I went on all these 12-step calls with him. That was the secret. And I still do the same thing today when I get a 12-step. I get a new guy. I get to his dirty place, wherever he is, and I get down, and I look in his eyes. You know what I see? I see my eyes 41 years ago. I never want to see that look in my eyes again. And I'll get some guy and clean him up and take him to a meeting, go to a coffee shop after the meeting. And this is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. Look across the table, and the power's in his eyes. That night, one meeting, and the power's in his eyes. And I gave a guy a cake a little while back with 39 years. And I got to see the light come on in his eyes. So if you're having trouble with a higher power, I suggest you do that for a while. Because I certainly believe. So whatever was wrong in my life, he told me to do something for you. We call it service, if you're new. It's a secret word for love. Doing for each other. Service. Mother Teresa was in our area a number of years ago, and she had a heart attack, and she was in the hospital. And one of my friends was a cardiologist, took care of it. And he said, Cliff, you had to be in a room with that woman to know that she was a real spiritual being. And some reporter had asked her this question, and the answer was in the paper. And I cut it out, and I carried it around in my wallet until it just disintegrated, you know, turned yellow. But her answer to the reporter was, the fruit of faith is love. And the fruit of love is service. And the fruit of service is peace. I will comprehend the word serenity, and I will know peace. And the fruit of service is peace. So that anything I've ever done here is so that I can stay here. Love is really a funny thing, isn't it? You know, when I was in college, when I graduated college, I was going in this master's program, and the counselor was looking over my transcript, and he said, oh, I see you're a philosophy minor. I said, no, I'm a history minor. And this guy said, well, that might be, but you have more philosophy units than you do history units. And I hadn't known that. And what I hadn't known then, and it took me a long time to find out, that I was looking for a spiritual answer all my life. That's what I was looking for. And when I look back on it, every one of those great philosophers that I read and studied had the same statement. The way to be happy is to love. Has nothing to do with being loved. Love is the only thing you can't give away without getting more of it.
And I'd read all those great philosophers, and I had to learn that from an electrician, for Christ's sake. But I learned it. What's that? 5 minutes. Okay. When the red one comes on, you take off your glasses, and they don't know. So I did all the service. I was talking to a little gal before the meeting who's really into service, and I'm glad to hear that. You know, I was a GSR and a DCM. I did the whole damn alphabet. And area treasurer, area blah, blah, blah. And end up being delegate. Panel 26 was like just before the Ice Age. You know, and it was a tremendous experience to go back to New York for those 2 years, that kind of thing. And my buddies used to kid me. They were doing other stuff in AA, all my old buddies. They'd say, "Hey, Cliff, here comes the politician. How's the politics going, Cliff?" And I used to say to my buddies back then, 35 years ago, I used to say, "I do this because I want AA to be here for my kids if they need it. And I want it to be AA. I don't want it to be some watered-down, psychologized BS. I want it to be the 12 steps the little sponsor brought to me. I want it to be AA. Our youngest son has 23 years of sobriety. Our middle daughter had 12 years and got a bad back and started taking pills. And I'm like Scott. You know, I have no opinion on pills. They'll cut you off in the sunlight of spirit and kill your ass dead, but I have no opinion on them whatsoever." And she drank again and was drunk for a little while. Now she has about 10 years again now. And the hashish salesman has almost 10 years. He's one of the experts in the world on the growing of coffee. Beats the hell out of what he used to grow, you know. As we speak, he's in Africa, in Tanzania in Africa. He goes all over the world. He goes into third world countries and decides what has to be done about the coffee crops, you know, the plants, what has to be brought in the soil. And then the volunteers follow him in, and they don't have to be third world countries anymore in the growing of coffee. And he speaks Spanish fluently. He goes to meetings all over South America, Central America, Mexico. His favorite meeting is in Zambia, Africa. And he'll be there in a couple nights. And our eldest daughter kind of went wrong. She's been in Al-Anon about 25 years now. She's a dynamite Al-Anon. My wife and my daughter Kitty are two of the greatest examples I have ever seen of the power in the program. And if you're new here tonight, I've got news for you. The program is step 1 through 12. All the rest of it is fun and games, and I love the fun and games. I wouldn't lie to you. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon is steps 1 through 12. And if you take them and you're like me, they'll change your entire life. You will never be the same again. And my wife and my daughter are two of the greatest examples people who've taken those 12 steps and changed their lives. And so our family gets together now. We have a hell of a time, you know. We all get together and laugh and scratch. Nobody has to be anybody for anybody else in that program. We love each other for fun and for free. That's what it's all about, isn't it? I am so grateful that you allowed me to come to this meeting one more time. This was on my bucket list. What's that one? You know, I talked to you about doing a 12-step work, looking in guys' eyes. I don't know, about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I was rereading Leaves of Grass, Walt Whitman, which is one of my favorite works. And all of a sudden, this little paragraph in Whitman, Leaves of Grass, leaped up at me. And what he said in the Leaves of Grass, he said, "Why should I want to see God better than this day? I see God in every day. In every moment therein." Then he said, "In the eyes of the men and women, I see God. And in my own eyes, in the glass." Thanks.
commitments available. Celebrate AA birthdays at this meeting. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, anything which would affect you from the neck up. If you're a regular attendee this meeting would like to take a cake with us, please email our assistant scribe, Valerie G, at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org.
Hello, I'm Valerie. I'm an alcoholic.
And please email her or Ann before 6:30. Otherwise, you'll have to wait until the following week to get recognized. We have several birthdays tonight, and we've asked a special guest to come out and sing a song for us.
Hey, everybody. Patrick, alcoholic. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Ace. Happy birthday to you. Keep coming back.
Thank you, Patrick. And our birthdays for this week. We have Harlan F. for 1 year. His sponsor is Drew D. We have Allie B. for 5 years. Her sponsor is Mackenzie S. We have David H. for 5 years. His sponsor is Ned A. We have April S. for 8 years. Her sponsor is Linda L. We have Mackenzie S. for 8 years. Her sponsor is Hilda F. Jason Z. for 10 years. His sponsor is Robert C. Dave W. for 11 years. His sponsor is Ashok D. We have Penny V. for 18 years. Her sponsor is Quincy W. We have Kristen M. for 27 years. Her sponsor is Linda W. We have Cecilia C. for 32 years. Her sponsor is Rita R. We have Chris M. for 34 years. His sponsor is Tom B. We have Sheila L. for 40 years. Her sponsor is Sharon C. We have Patrick McKay for 40 years. His sponsor is Lewis L. So we had 13 birthdays for a total of 239 years, the average being 18.38. Happy birthday to all of our recipients. We have a custom in the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our birthday cake at the end of the year. This candle money is our contributions to AA organizations worldwide. If you wish to participate in this custom, please email our treasurer, Betty H., at treasurer@pacificgroupla.org.